The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 235, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello folks, Dan Reed here. A cutting board. Yeah, that thing is often overlooked even when it's worn out. Mostly the choices at the grocery store are flimsy, floppity boards that are too small and too thin and too no good. Most food TV shows are using booze boards, like boo, B-O-O-S. A booze board is large enough to work on, made from hardwood like walnut or maple, and will last for years. No kidding, for years. Shop the selection of booze boards at my affiliate, linked at culinarylibertarian.com/cuttingboard. Elaine Mendoza is my guest today. Elaine left her corporate job in 2015 to pursue a happier life with more freedom. Since then, she has traveled the world continuously. Her world travels have given her a direct classroom to cultures and food worldwide. Her adventurous spirit won her the title of Changemaker by the Gandhi Foundation in 2017. Her book, Humanized, The Journey Back to You Without Labels, reached number one under LGBTQ+ memoirs and number two under spirituality. Her TEDx talk, The Power of Labels to Change Your Story, was well received, and in this speech, she openly explored the four controversial labels that affected her life: immigrant, Latina, female, and part of the LGBTQ+ community. Hello, Elaine. Thank you for joining me today on the Eating Liberty Podcast.
Hi, Dan. Nice to meet you, finally.
Nice to meet you. So, yeah, what the listeners don't know is lots of things got in the way. One of those things was you relocated from one place to another. Mm-hmm. And one of those things was your mother passed, which was very sad. And I'm sorry about that. Before we get into, we're going to talk a little bit about, we're going to talk about food because this is the Eating Liberty show. But we're also going to talk about labels, and I want you to explain more about what that means, and then I think there's relevant content to be had there, and I think it's almost a circle. Label creates the thing, and the thing creates the label. It's like, how do you get off of this merry-go-round? But before we do that, a quick bio about you, please.
I lived the American dream, so to speak. You know, I found myself at 40 years old having everything that we work for, a good job, a nice apartment. But I felt that there was something missing in my life. I just didn't get to live it. It seems that in American culture, we arrange our lives around work and not around our happiness, what brings us joy. So I ended up selling everything, leaving the job and fulfilling my dreams of traveling the world and finding a way to fund that. It was a big risk, a big leap of faith. And since then, I've written two books. I've done a TED Talk, conferences. A lot of my dreams came true because of that leap of faith. So I encourage people, live your lives. Don't arrange it around work because they will replace you immediately.
Yeah. Well, I think for the most part, that's probably true. And since you have been around the world and I have not, you probably could speak to is that drive for employment, sacrificing physical and mental health, a uniquely American thing, or is it a people thing?
I don't think it's a uniquely American thing, but I have traveled to many countries where people don't even ask me what I do for a living. They don't care. So I would say it's greatly an American thing from my experience, But in my world travels, it's only in America where work is sort of the center of the universe. And in other countries like Spain, Portugal, they're like, how are you doing today? How are you? You know, they don't ask you, what do you do? Never. They never ask me that.
That's interesting. Now, I don't know anything about Japan except for what I've watched and read. And it seems to me, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, it seems to me that at least the things that are presented, and maybe it's propaganda, that the Japanese lifestyle is also very work-oriented, almost to the point that your work is your identity.
This is true, actually. I have not been to Japan, but I do have a lot of Japanese clients. And they tell me that they're expected to work even harder than Americans, that they work all the time, sometimes 6-7 days a week. So yeah, it is like that in Japan as well. And they also have mental health issues and suicide rates that are quite high as well.
Yeah. Well, those are not good things.
Oh, no, not good things. I'm not saying that work isn't important. Work is important, but I'm also saying that it's a part of our lives. Everything else deserves to be watered and enjoyed as well and nourished.
Well, balance. Balance is that we talk in when I talk to people who are dietitians and people who talk about eating for health and wellness, one of the except for the extremes, and there's lots of those, they're going to get mad if I say it. The carnivore folks are extreme because they're excluding a lot of stuff. I keep saying Granny was right.
Yeah.
Moderation and balance. And that seems to be the thing, not just in, so we could make an analogy, not just in the diet of food, but in the diet of life, recreation, employment. You need quiet time. You need time for, even if self-reflection is nothing more than navel gazing, you need time where people are bothering you.
Yes. And since you mentioned Granny, my grandmother is about to turn 103. So I think she knows a thing or two about living a long and healthy life. And she mentioned that to me. I asked her, what is the secret to a long life? And she said, stress, that we shouldn't have a lot of stress. Because she says pain happens, problems happen, but we can learn to manage our stress. And she did it by having a job she enjoyed. She balanced her life. She had good food, organic food. She even asked me, I don't even know what organic is, as opposed to what, because she was used to having her own garden in the backyard and eating her own food. So, yeah.
So it never would have occurred to her. And probably if it needed fertilization or pest management, there's probably ancient, we call it ancient, but there's probably just ways that they knew what to do. You take this plant and you make this tincture of it and you spray it on the tomatoes and it keeps the bugs away. And it's that's fascinating. So in your TED Talk, I think you mentioned your grandmother and talking about how she had a really profound impact on you and food in your life.
Oh, yes, my grandmother, for sure, yes. My grandmother is a self-taught chef. And when I say self-taught, I mean she can cook anything and everything. And it just makes sense to her. She didn't go to culinary school, but she'll be like, oh yeah, I'm going to stuff some chickens or some Cornish hens. And she ties it up and debones it. And I'm like, Grandma, who taught you how to do this? She's like, well, women back then, we just knew how to do all of these things. And she had a big influence on my life because she was known in the town that my family is from as one of the best cooks in the city. And she also did a lot of catering and she did a lot of baking. She did quinceañera cakes as well as wedding cakes. She just had a talent with her hands that I haven't seen in another person. And she makes wedding dresses as well. I mean, her hands is
excellent.
Yeah.
So sewing, I can mend a pair of pants. I can darn some socks. So I can do a few things, but I can't do that. And I know a lady in New York who, She does, one of her business is giving tours in Lower Manhattan for, it's called the Patriot Tour. So where Washington would have been at Fonce's Tavern or the Hamilton/Burr Tour. And because she's talking about the colonial era, she makes her own colonial period clothing.
Oh my God.
Which is, and it, so I've watched the progress. And so at first it was like, oh, I'm really nervous. I don't know what I'm doing. Now it's just the skill has exploded. It's magnificent what she can do. And it's just, so I can't do that. So good for her. Well, you know, there's, I don't know how it is, and so your grandmother has, sounds like she just has this sense of innovation, just like, let's take the bones out and put something in and we'll roll it up and we'll bake it or something. It just makes perfect sense.
Flavor
is a weird thing because we don't all taste bitter. Those who taste bitter don't taste bitter the same. Some get it. Some are like, oh my gosh, that's so bitter. And either you like it or hate it. Same with acid, same with sweet. So that's kind of a weird thing because how can you know, you can't, how someone else perceives that flavor. But just thinking about, and I get asked this question and I can't give an answer to it. The question is, how do you put things together? And the answer I can give is you have to taste everything to at least sort of get a taste library in your brain. You have to sort of remember what everything tastes like. So I know I hate maraschino cherries because I've tasted a few of them.
Yeah.
But so you taste a kind of blue cheese and walnuts and sage, and those things go together. And you think about maybe butternut squash, you make a butternut squash ravioli, and you just sort of, it's what I just think about the flavors. How can I make them sing with that thing? What do I have to do to the walnuts to make them taste better in the soup? Oh, I know what to do. I don't know what to do. I don't have an answer for that. I don't, but I can put these things together. It sounds like that's what grandma's doing, is just thinking about, what do you have? Because you can't make something if you don't have the ingredient. What do I have to work with? What can I use? And then no school's going to tell you that because no school can.
That's true. Yeah.
How cool. So that's a really fun background to have. And then you travel the world and say, well, yeah, it's fine, but Granny did it better.
it's amazing, and I tried to impress her by bringing her different stuff from different parts of the world. Hey, Grandma, here's this coffee. Here's this, and she's like, "Well, it's not quite as good as Venezuelan coffee, but you know, I'll take it."
You thought of me, and that was very sweet. Thank you so much, Elaine. This is almost a loaded question because I think we've addressed it, but how has that experience sort of raised the bar for you, for your own home cooking, and maybe even more problematically for people who know about Granny, who invite you over?
Yeah.
Like, has anybody refused to cook for you because they know it's not going to meet Granny's expectations? And then you're going to be disappointed because Granny could do it better.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that because just now over the Christmas time, I have a very good friend from my childhood that knows my granny as well. And she told me, you know, it was your granny that taught me how to make hallacas. Now, hallacas is a Venezuelan Christmas specialty. It is out of this world delicious, but it is a 3-day process.
Wow.
So she told me, Elena, you know, your grandma taught me, but then she was nervous. She's like, but you know, I don't know if they're going to be as good as your grandma's. So keep your expectations, you know, just keep them a little low because I'm not your grandma. So I notice people are a little nervous to feed me in their house, especially if they know my grandma. So yeah, I've noticed that.
I, when I, and I grew up with my cousins in the same town. It was a couple of minutes drive. And so my aunt was as much a mom to me as my mom was. We were at each other's house. We spent holidays together all the time. I started culinary school. And she actually said, I'm not cooking for you. What do you mean? I'm in culinary school. I'm not teaching culinary school. I'm just a student. No. I'm not cooking. She said, you have fed me my whole life.
Yeah.
What changed? Well, that finally went away. But so that was a very bizarre thing to happen. Now people are sort of, well, I usually get it now. It's like, oh, well, get the chef to chime in. Is this tri-tip done? Like, you've been cooking tri-tip for 30 years before you met me. You know if it's done.
Yeah,
you don't need me to come in and tell you this because I'm. It's a weird position to be in.
Yeah.
What if I say no? No, you screwed it up. Throw it all away and start again. Come on, that's I don't want to be in that spot. So let's move a bit more into food and this culture thing. So. It's a strange thing to consider in America that food isn't really the driving force of our culture, because it's almost an easy argument to refute. Look on the corner of any intersection in any city, and at four corners you're going to see five fast food joints.
Yeah.
So it's not that food isn't part of our culture. Fast, convenient, instant food is really part of our culture, and that really goes back to commercialization of things. And maybe it was to show, look what man can do with machinery. We're going to take macaroni and cheese, put it in a box. We're going to take a bunch of noodles, cook them, dry them, put some spices in there, call it hamburger help, put it in a box.
Yeah.
And maybe it was intended to be this incredible time-saving innovation. Go, so you've done with the work, don't spend time in the kitchen, innovate. Use this package and go recreate outside with your kids. Maybe I'm romanticizing intent, I don't know. But now, fine dining, even moderate fine dining, where you're sitting down eating food that was legitimately all cooked, where, okay, so you bought the pasta, but you made homemade macaroni and cheese from scratch, you grated the cheese, made the roux, did all that. I'm not saying you got to make your own cheese, make your own pasta. That's probably too much. But there's this weird thing. I think convenience and access to instant really seems to be an American thing. Now, because you have this experience in Europe, it is... And I romanticize Europe as being these guardians of the old ways, but maybe I'm wrong. Are they sort of bending down to this convenience, to fast packets?
I noticed by entering the supermarket in Spain that they don't have a lot of convenient foods. So you'll find, you know, your pre-made salads, you'll find your packages of very upscale charcuterie for very cheap prices. But you won't find a lot of foods that you can just put in the microwave, because the Spanish pride themselves in fresh foods. So when you walk down the cereal aisle or the fast food aisle, right, it's very, very small. You won't find a lot of things. A couple cereals, maybe three or four, but they're not big on it. I think they do it for the expats that live there. I have yet to see, you know, a Spanish person having cereal with milk. It's just not their thing. They think it's, you know, astronaut food or something. They want their eggs and their bread and, you know, they want to cook. They want a hot meal. And they eat about five times a day, I noticed. So I was surprised, because they literally do eat five times a day. So they have the breakfast, then they have the mid-morning snack, then they have the lunch, then the mid-afternoon snack, And then they have the big dinner sometime after 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And they're thin. They're slim people. I'm like, how is this possible?
Now this is interesting because I've gone sort of keto-ish, and part of what that includes is really mostly it means I've excluded a lot of bread, a lot of bread products, a lot of grain things. Once in a while, I'll bring a little bit back, but not to the extent they did. And the main thing is sweets are gone.
Yeah.
Which the rest of my body is perfectly happy about. My brain is still mad at me. It's like, you know, I really wanted some of that.
I understand.
But it's made a difference in the amount of flab I'm carrying around, and I'm happy about that. Mm. And I have energy that I didn't have before, so I'm happy about that. So part of the keto-ish thing is this intermittent fasting. And so eating at 10 o'clock at night and then getting up, what time is breakfast? I guess that's really the first important question.
They whenever they get up in the morning, they'll have coffee, you know, on the way to work or something, with something sweet, which is usually some kind of long sweet bread. And I'm just like, how do these people stay so slim? But I think that I noticed how small their portions are, so in comparison to our portions in the West. So it took a little getting used to for me when I first got there. I'm like, well, this soda is tiny and this meal is tiny. It's delicious and it's well cooked, but it's small. It's a small portion in comparison to what we're used to in the States.
I wonder if satiety, now this is a hard thing to define, but I wonder if satiety for the group of people known as the Spanish is different than for the group of people as the Americans. And certainly there are some Americans who are perfectly happy with small portions and not overeating, and they can manage that very well. And there are others who, well, if Big Macs are 2 for 1, I better get 2. I read them both.
Yeah. It's savings.
So I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting observation.
Yes. Yes.
So let's, in your TED talk, I teased it with labels. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to put a link to the TED talk on the show notes page, which is culinarylibertarian.com/235. But, so explain what a label is. I'm pretty sure people know what that is. But then how does the label impact the person? And how does that impact on the person affect food choice?
Except food. How does it affect food choices, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a label is initially, it was, created, labels are created to help tell a story, to help describe a person. So for example, as a writer, I can say, you know, I saw a handsome Italian man walking down the street. Italian would be a label. You're describing his ethnicity or his nationality. The problem is not using a label to describe something. The problem is when we start using it to cause division, to cause even separation or hatred even between us. So I started to pay attention. And now I am an immigrant and I am Latin American as well. I started to pay attention how the media portrayed my ethnicity or my background. So I started to notice newspaper headlines or news headlines. And you will hear something like Mexican immigrant crossed the border and killed a nice lady, a nice American born bred lady. But you won't hear the same headline when there's a native born American. You don't see native born American goes into a school and shoots other Americans. So on one side, it creates fear because it's like, oh, those Mexican immigrants are dangerous. On the other side, you're not even focusing on the nationality or the ethnicity. it's not a fair game. So it's very manipulative the way labels are used in our media and newspapers and so on, because they're trying to create that fear and we don't notice it. It's very subtle. But then the arguments start, oh, we have to be against the immigrants for this reason. We have to be against this for this reason. The label is not used to describe. It's used to cause fear or even hatred against a whole group of people. And then anyone with that label is treated the same way.
Well, we saw that at 9/11.
Yes.
If you're a Muslim in America, I think probably you better be looking around.
Yes, yes. And I mentioned that in my TED Talk. I'm like, what does the word Muslim mean to you after 9/11? How do you look at Muslims? You
know? Because I have no way of gauging this, and partly because of where I live, I don't actually know if there's Muslims here. There might be. I have no idea. If they are, then they're blending in, then I'm not paying attention. But I think given the time span and the relative youth of a whole generation who didn't go through all of that, like, I mean, living as an adult, it was very, very noticeable. I think if you're, 19 years or younger, it's entirely possible that that just didn't happen to you. You just don't know what that's about. And because I'm not 19 or younger, I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know. If you have any way to, if you notice that, is that even close to right? Or is that just...
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Have you noticed that even, say, in Europe or in Mexico, that the further away you get from one of those polarizing events, the less impact it seems to be having on the generation that followed it?
I think my experience with the newer generation is they are smarter than we were, so they're not as easily manipulated. And one of the things that I realized as a traveler is that what makes the headlines here is not remotely what makes the headlines overseas. You know, they're looking at the world in a different way. So, for example, we're predominantly Christian, Catholic, a lot of Christian religions in the West. Whereas when I talk to my Turkish clients or Saudi Arabian clients, Jesus and Christianity is a very obscure thing for them. They don't understand it. They're not as immersed in it. So that's when I realized that what's important in the U.S. seems to be only important in the U.S.
Well, I think that that might be something that could be said for even the Turks and the Saudis, because
mm-hmm. Yes.
I am completely uninformed about what the daily goings on are in Mexico, in Venezuela, in France, in Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Now, part of that is my own fault for not going and looking. Oh. And I don't watch the news, but I think part of that is I agree with you that the labels are used as tools for fear and division and anything that can gin up fear and dependence on the next thing the media says is really, if you're the media, you want that.
Yes.
So telling to me about things happening someplace that don't impact me doesn't stir up fear in me. So what use is that?
Yes. And realize that they are very aware that there's a certain prejudice against the Muslim world. They are aware of this. They tell me all the time. And the reason I realized this, I once met a nice young man. His family owns hotels in his country. And I remember meeting him during my travels, and he was very nervous. When he found out I was American, he was very nervous to tell me where he was from. And I'm like, well, where are you from? Oh, he's like, out east. Long story short, he was from Pakistan. And he said, I was afraid to tell you because every time I enter your country, I have to go through this line. And then they question me for 3 hours to the point that I don't even want to go anymore. It's such a hassle. So they are aware that there's a certain prejudice against a certain group of people coming into the U.S.
When you were talking, that's too many talks. When you were mentioning about food labels, mm-hmm. What is a food label that's going to be used as a pejorative or as something to cause anxiety in an eater?
I noticed here in Mexico, it's very interesting what they're doing here in Mexico. I haven't been in the U.S. in a while, but I notice here whenever you buy something, it will pop out and say, excessive sugars, not good for your health. I've noticed it on cookies, on sodas, on chips and stuff, Cheetos, potato chips. It says stuff like excessive trans fats or whatnot. So they're telling you, that's the first thing they're showing it on the package. And they consider that to be responsible. And I noticed as well, they're hiding the labels at supermarkets. This is new. It wasn't like that last time I was here. They're hiding cigarettes, so they cannot be on display anymore. So if you go to like a 7-Eleven, they have to put a curtain in front of it. You cannot see the labels because really? Not good for you. So you have to ask them, do you have cigarettes? Yes, we have cigarettes. Boom. They raise the curtain, but they're not allowed to be on display anymore. And I thought that was interesting. It wasn't like that two and a half years ago. So this is a new thing that's happening in Mexico. I don't know if that's happening in the States yet, but I can imagine it's not happening yet.
I haven't seen the curtain, but it's been some while that the cigarettes used to be on the shelf and then it seems like my whole lifetime ago, but now they're behind the counter. You have to ask the clerk for the cigarette. There's a lot of, so it's the FDA, well, it's not just the U.S. It does sort of impact the rest of the world, but here they'll say, they'll write on the little, somehow call it out that this is trans fat free, which is only partly right, because it's not, if the serving of the thing is less than, I'm going to get this part wrong, but if it's less than, say, 1% trans fat, they can call it trans fat free. So it's not zero, but it's within the threshold that counts as zero. There's big balloons about things. This is trans fat free, but don't, what they should say is, don't look at the sugar part, which is going to be like 50%. Or you can buy a package of mushrooms that'll say gluten-free. No kidding.
Gluten-free is
good. Gluten-free. Oh, all right. That's good. So there's lots of – it's not trickery exactly, because obviously mushrooms are gluten-free. Of course they are. Yeah. So is water.
And potato chips are gluten-free.
Yeah, but they're not good for you.
No.
So I think when we start getting into labeling, going from the food to the people, I think there's some real psychological problems that can happen. Now, if you live on peanut M&Ms and cigarettes and you are 6'2" and razor thin, what are they going to say? Yeah, well, look at me. I'm perfect. If you aren't that, if looking at the pastry case puts 10 pounds on, then we have a problem. And I don't know, I think society has gotten a little bit better. And I really mean, I hope that means a whole lot better about not being name calling, about people who are struggling with whatever it is they're struggling with. And usually from what we can see, it appears to be a weight issue. Well, we have no way of knowing. We only go by what we can see. We don't know what's going on. Maybe there's some real health problems. And what you didn't see the person 3 months ago. So maybe this is a big improvement. But in your experience, when people are dealing with these kinds of labels, what's going on with them?
Well, I realized in my experience as traveling and eating in other countries is I started to learn that some of our food ingredients are not allowed in other parts of the world. So I thought that was interesting because I was not aware of this until I started seeing other countries. So for example, what would be a good example? High fructose corn syrup. That's a good example. It is legal in the US, but it's not legal in many other parts of the world. You won't see it in Coca-Cola in Europe, for example, which is probably why some of these sodas taste so good, because they still use the old formula, because high fructose corn syrup is not allowed. So I find it interesting that the FDA would censor something like authentic French cheeses, for example, but then high fructose corn syrup is fine. I even saw an article the other day that said that in America, it's easier to buy a gun than to, what did I say? It's easier to buy a gun in America than to find authentic French cheese.
Well, I don't think that's true at all, because I know exactly where to go to get the authentic French cheese.
Non-pasteurized?
Yep.
Oh, good for you. But it's not easy
to find. It's hard to find, but I know where it is.
Yeah, okay.
And I have yet to figure out how to buy a gun, so. the labeling, the European labeling laws, especially with those dyes, the red dye 40 is the one everyone's like, oh, but it's so, yeah, you're right. The FDA will be perfectly happy to let you eat all the high fructose corn syrup and all of the blue and green and red food dyes you can stand, but they won't put them in Lucky Charms for the French, which you can't have. you can't have the thing that's actually going to do you good, which is unpasteurized cheese that's been aged 180 days.
Yeah.
Because that's going to actually make you better.
Yeah.
Which is a real shame. But can you get raw milk in Mexico? Do the Mexicans drink milk?
They drink quite a bit of it. And some of it is, I don't really buy milk out here, but I have noticed it comes in these little carton things and it's not in the refrigerator. I don't know how it stays fresh for so long, but these little carton boxes, and they're just kind of out on the normal shelves, not refrigerated or anything. So yeah, they drink quite a bit of milk and they eat quite a bit of sugar as well. Heavy on the sugar out here.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, is it possible that it is packaged in a way that, no, I have no idea about this, but is it possible that it's packaged in a way that preserves its integrity as a raw milk ingredient, but also eliminates the pathogens? Or are the packages kefir? Is that what it is?
I, to be honest with you, I don't know. I just, because I don't buy it, I'm not reading the labels. I just thought it was unusual to find milk not refrigerated. It's just kind of in the normal shelves. Of course, they have the fresh refrigerated milk as well. They do have that in supermarkets in the glass bottles that looks like it came out of the farm and cost a lot more than the other milk. But they drink quite a bit of milk out here. And even the fruit smoothies or the green smoothies, I didn't realize at first, but I have to tell them, no, please don't put sugar in my fruit smoothie.
Yeah, no.
I mean, I've seen them make the fruit smoothies. I'm like, oh my God, you just put like two huge tablespoons of sugar. But yeah, you have to request it without sugar.
Interesting. Yeah. So I think I mentioned at the top of the show that your mother passed. Mm-hmm. We're talking about labels, but I want to talk about labels on a person. And It's been a few years, but both of my parents have passed, and it was a very strange thing.
Yeah.
To think that at the age of 50-ish, I'm now an orphan. I think the definition is correct, but it doesn't really apply. It seems like something we say for the 6-year-old.
Yeah.
But it was a weird thing. And so what have you noticed about your eating preferences, eating changes, maybe nothing has happened. But I know, I'm guessing that you went, this was a transition. And so how did this label of being now the child of a mother who has died, how does this change you? What does this do for your food?
Funny enough, I remember we were supposed to originally talk the day that she passed away. So, of course, I forgot everything. I was just in a state of shock. But I realized right after she passed away, I just couldn't eat. I lost my appetite. I wasn't really that hungry. I remember just getting nuts because at least it's nutritious and gives you a lot of calories very quickly. My appetite was deeply affected. And it just, as my therapist told me in the past, is that grief, when you go to a normal eating schedule or a normal sleeping schedule, it's almost like telling yourself, okay, it's time to move on. But when we get kind of stuck in this time capsule of, no, I'm not ready to move on, so I'm not going to eat and I'm not going to sleep. So that was the way my therapist in the past described grief to me. So what I did at the time was I planned a trip to Italy. I said, okay, if there's something that's going to zap me out of this not wanting to eat thing, it's definitely Italy. So I ended up going there for about 5 days just to take a hiatus from the world and see if my appetite would open up. And it didn't take very long in Italy because they have such amazing foods. And I almost found pleasure in it again. I'm like, oh, I was so hungry. I didn't realize how hungry I was. but now I find myself thinking about, oh, my mom cooked this that way and she did it this way. And I'm thinking of all the things that she taught me how to cook, you know, as a way to remember her or even feel like I still have a connection to her. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yeah.
Is this Granny's daughter?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
She went first. Grandma's still around. Yeah.
I'm guessing that's probably a shocked Granny.
Yes, but my mom had dementia, so we were seeing her deteriorate for 10 years. And by the time she left, it was almost like, oh, Jesus, take her, because she was suffering a lot. And my mom was in the end stages, which was very difficult to watch. So my grandmother just said, well, she's my baby's resting in peace. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's for people who haven't experienced it, it's hard. It might be a difficult concept to say that it's kind of a blessing that the pain and the suffering is over is a good thing.
Yes. Yes. And I did lose both my parents, and people always ask me what is best, when you lose them suddenly or when you lose them. I'm like, when you lose your parents, it sucks no matter how it happens. Because my dad did go suddenly. He had an aneurysm. I'm like, they're both very challenging, just in different ways. But there is a sense of letting go when it's a long illness, because you don't want to see your loved ones suffer either. So when I found out the news, that was my reaction as well. I'm like, Mom, you're resting now. You don't have this awful illness anymore. You're at peace.
Right. Yeah, both of mine, not together, but both of my parents died from cancer, and it was it wasn't years, and my brother died of cancer.
giving up sugar is good for that. From what I've read.
Yeah, we didn't know that then, but by the time my mom and my dad were diagnosed, it was just like, this is. It had metastasized into little teeny BB sized things in her brain. There's nothing they can do about that.
Nothing they can do about that. Yeah.
And diet might have helped. I have no idea. Who knows? There's no way to know that stuff. But slow, I mean, I don't know. Tough call. I don't know. None of the above. That's what's better. So now, originally I was going to ask you this question about Europe, and now that you're living, and you can answer if it was Europe, but now that you're in Mexico, tell me about spending the least and getting the most. So you're going to go maybe street food or this little tiny bodega that makes fabulous something. Mm-hmm. Can you do that in Mexico?
Yes. It's amazing because Mexico is so visited. I mean, the tourism here is huge. But I noticed the nice restaurants that look beautiful, and then you get tacos and you're like, what? It's like 10 times the price. I mean, you can get tacos at a stand here for about 15 pesos, the mom and pop little street food tacos, which are very authentic as it can get. Or you can go to a restaurant and get, you know, three tacos that are beautifully presented for over 200 pesos. So we're literally talking 10 times the amount. And then some, even. So
what is the conversion? I don't know how much a peso correlates to.
Right now, it's roughly $1 is about 18, between 17 and 18 pesos at the moment. So if you can get one taco for about 15 pesos, let's say it's about 80 cents, more or less. So imagine paying, you know, 80 cents versus, 10 bucks or 15 bucks for these touristy places. They're good. They taste amazing, but you're paying significantly more for it. So.
Now, I'm sure people have asked this, but I'm just curious, since I've got you here. How do you think Taco Bell would go over in your neighborhood?
You know, it's funny. I know there's a lot of bloggers and stuff, and they get very snooty. And I always tell people, you know what? There's a place in my heart for Taco Bell. I mean, I've enjoyed it in my life. I still go to it when I go to the U.S., but at the same time, yeah, it's not authentic, but it doesn't mean it isn't good.
I used to go there with my cousins, the same aunt who decided she wouldn't cook for me. Taco Bell had some very interesting digestive issues with all of us. And so it became, the only reason we go to Taco Bell was just so we could be boys and have toilet humor fun 6 hours later.
What I think is funny, though, is seeing Taco Bell overseas. You know, in the U.S., it's cheap food when you have like $5 left in your pocket or whatever. But you have to realize that this is an international chain. So overseas, it's actually more expensive.
Really?
It's considered kind of a treat. It's not a cheap place to eat.
No
kidding. So I thought that was interesting for me to discover.
I would never have thought of that.
Yeah.
So in Europe, could you do the same thing? Could you save like $5 or I guess, I don't remember what the euro equivalences are, but could you get good food on the cheap in different places in Europe?
The mom and pop places, if you look for the daily menu, there's a lot of daily menus nowadays after the pandemic. Probably between 10 and 12 euros, you'll get like an appetizer, an entree, dessert, and coffee, and one drink, which I think is pretty good for the euro because Europe is more expensive than Mexico. But a lot of people don't think to look for the menu of the day or even ask if they don't speak the language. But in Spain, sure. I even see a lunch menu for 5 euros that includes the bocadillo, which is, you know, a really nice sandwich with delicious charcuterie, and a drink for 5 euros. You know, you can still get that, but it's a really delicious sandwich with you know, salchichon, which is the really good salami that they have in Spain, or jamón, the cured hams in Spain that they have so many of them. I cannot keep up, but this is a nice sandwich that you're getting with a drink for 5 euros.
So one of the things you brought up in your TED Talk was perceived value. So that 80 cent or 15 peso taco to that 100, 200 peso taco, it seems to me like you're saying the perceived value isn't there.
Yeah, I think what happens is tourists are afraid in general, in any country, in any place, they're afraid of the street food. They don't realize that there are health standards here as well, and even the food trucks have to follow the health standards. But I think it's just fear. People feel more comfortable going into a restaurant and paying more than eating in the corner food truck. So I think it's just that fear of being a foreigner in a different country that you don't know.
Well, you know, they tell you don't drink the water. So why would you eat the food?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It is true, though. Don't drink the water. In Mexico, it's definitely true.
This is just silliness, but do you think that they tell the Mexican tourists coming to America, don't drink the water?
Probably not. I was curious, and I forgot once about the whole water thing. I had a soda, and it had ice in it, and the ice wasn't filtered, and I felt the effects very quickly. And I realized it was true. The water here, I don't know if it has extra minerals. I don't know what it is, but it makes you delicate very quickly, to put it nicely. But I don't hear Mexicans saying, oh, yeah, we can't drink the water in the U.S. I haven't heard that.
So now, I had always thought it was just because it was a pathogen problem, and it wasn't that it is – it's not like it's just, it's normal for that area, but because as a tourist, your system isn't ready for what that is.
Yes,
because Mexicans drink Mexican water every day. But if your system isn't ready for that,
yes,
you're in big trouble.
From what I hear, the water here has a lot of minerals, not necessarily just heavy on the minerals, that you don't want to drink that. And it affects your skin and your hair. Even when I come here, I have to put so much conditioner so that my hair actually moves a little. I do feel the difference. So imagine drinking that. If it's making your hair kind of rough, imagine what it would do if you actually drink it. It might be good for animals, but maybe not good for humans.
Interesting. You know? Well, I never knew. I mean, I should never – I've never been anywhere. I went to Canada once. So interesting. Mm-hmm. My new book, 50 Things to Know About Being a Chef, is due for release on April 7th. Pre-ordering is available for all formats, well, at least reading, Kindle, hardback, and paperback. And now I have an author page on Amazon. Find it on Amazon or click culinarylibertarian.com/author to pre-order my new book or buy your copy of Cooking for Comfort. All right. I'm going to move on to a little short answer part of the show. It's called The Quick Fire. Of the five flavors, bitter, salty, sweet, sour, or umami, which one is your favorite?
I really like sour for some reason. I'm really big on sour.
What's your favorite food?
Pasticho. Pasticho is a... you may not have heard of it, but there was a huge influx of Italian immigrants that came to Venezuela after World War II. They even say that one out of every three Venezuelan has Italian blood. So what the Venezuelans saw lasagna and they said, okay, this is pretty good, but how can we make it even better? So they added a layer of bechamel sauce or bechamel, however you pronounce it. I've heard it different ways. So they added a layer of that. Some people will put charcuterie in it, and then that's became the Venezuelan pasticho, which is now a national dish. It's very popular there. It's very popular.
Sounds so fabulous. I like it.
It's lasagna with charcuterie on top.
Sounds perfect. What is your least favorite food?
My least favorite food. I'm not big on. They have these little liver part tacos out here with different parts of the cow, like brains and tongue. And to me, that's, I'm a foodie, but there are certain things that I draw the line that to me is like, oh, I can't eat this. Grasshoppers. I won't eat the grasshoppers out here. No, no, not doing it.
What sound do you love?
The ocean, the sound of the ocean.
What sound do you hate?
Construction. Every time I rent an Airbnb, boom, construction.
What gets you excited?
A new destination that I've never been to before.
What turns you off?
What turns me off? Racism.
If you could cook for anyone ever, who would that be?
If I could cook for anyone ever, mm-hmm. Who would that be? I would love to cook for Martha Stewart.
Ah.
It would be a little challenging, but I think she could get down with some pasticho.
What's your favorite food indulgence?
Indulgence. Arepas. Venezuelan arepas are delicious. You could have like four of them in one sitting, easy.
How can people follow you?
They can find me on Finally Elaine in any of the platforms, Facebook, Instagram.
All right. I'll put some of those on today's show notes page. And I'm going to say a fake goodbye here. I'm going to do a Patreon portion. It's called The Chef's Table. And so if you're not a Patreon supporter, you can't listen to the Chef's Table portion. So that's your call to action. Go become a patron. Bill, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Now that I figured out where we are.
Thank you, Dan, for having me.
It's been my pleasure. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll add Elaine's website link and her TED Talk link to the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/235. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you being here. I want to thank my Patreon supporters as well. Elaine's Chef Table portion is up on the Patreon. You get access to that and the bonus content when you become a patron. Follow the link for the support page on the show notes page. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.